Mr. Shepherd.
Yes, ma'am.
You have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any time for both?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, please, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, I am Mr. Shepherd. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Boykins. He has three issues before the court today. I'd like to focus on the first, which concerns the attempted murder sentence and the order from the trial court modifying that on November 6th. As the court's well aware, Mr. Boykins was convicted of a count of attempted murder on July 23rd, 2014. He appeared again in the trial court on October 5th of 2015. During that hearing, the trial court sentenced him on the record to a period of incarceration on that attempted murder charge of 20 years with 10 suspended. Following that hearing, in the actual order, the sentencing order is derived from the sentencing hearing. It did not reflect what the court said on the record. It reflected a sentence of 10 years with 5 suspended. Thereafter, on November, I believe it was the 5th of 2015, trial court brought parties back to essentially explain the discrepancy between what he said on the record during the sentencing hearing and the court's order executed the following day. And despite all the trial court's attempts to correct the mistake it made on the record, the order that came following this November hearing restated the sentence that it sought to correct.
So counsel, pretty much the moral of the story is no good deed goes unpunished. Is that pretty much the bottom line here?
That's correct. Or there's another one. Make sure you read what you sign.
There is that one. And, of course, the first order was correct in what the judge meant to have happen.
That's correct.
So tell us why this would not be a Scribner's mistake and couldn't be corrected in that manner.
Well, I think it can, and I think it can be remanded simply with an instruction to correct a clerical order. Quite honestly, and I sort of didn't discover this until after the court had received the record and we were in the petition phase. I suppose that I could have moved the court at any time prior to today or being docketed today, asking the court to correct that. But I wasn't really sure whether granting the record or receiving the record and being in the petition phase meant that it was docketed for purposes. So,
thank you for your candor, counsel. We appreciate that.
Well, in a sense, I believe it could be. I did want to address one thing, and that was brought up by Mr. Stallard in his brief, and he essentially, Mr. Stallard, I'm sure I'm going to let him speak for himself, but it seemed as though he took the position that because this is entitled a sentencing order, we should just disregard it entirely. And my concern with that is, the case law, Roe v. Commonwealth, which says that a circuit court speaks only through its written orders, doesn't say written sentencing orders. It says written orders. And this is an order from the court that is the most recent order from the trial court with respect to this charge, which by its plain language would indicate that it is changing the sentence. I mean, it actually uses the language, the sentence imposed in the charge of attempted murder, case number CR 14-529, is now 20 years with 10 suspended. And quite honestly, I don't know what Oz does behind the curtain with these orders. I don't know what orders go to the Department of Correction. That's just something that, I don't know. So I'm certainly not comfortable, and the appellant isn't comfortable with the way that is worded, because the way it's worded, it imposes a sentence that's beyond the statutory maximum for the offense. Concerning the second issue, the issue of shooting into an occupied building, I think the crucial inquiry, the threshold inquiry, is what is preserved with respect to that issue. In all candor, trial counsel in his motion to strike was very brief. It's on the joint appendix on page 166 through 169, and simply he says on the top of page 166 of the joint appendix at line 3, and I guess just to do a quick argument about that, Your Honor, I would argue that there was never any testimony as to who actually was shooting at the building, even if you accept the Commonwealth case. And he doesn't really go into any further detail concerning that issue. Now, what I think is instructive is the Commonwealth's response to that. Essentially, they take the position that it doesn't matter, that he was the initial actor, and that because of that, he's criminally responsible for anything that sort of flows therefrom. In my brief, I certainly didn't take the argument in the direction of whether you can impute malice to the victim or to the defendant for the lawful actions of the victim. And again, in all candor, I didn't see trial counsel arguing that, so I limited my argument to what is foreseeable in light of the circumstances surrounding the event. If the court will note in the record, there's very little evidence that the Commonwealth put forward about the relative positioning of the parties in this parking lot, the distance from them to the actual storefront that was shot. And in the Ellis case that I cited in brief, the court noted that those factors can, at some point, attenuate whether or not the defendant, Mr. Boykins in this case, knew or should have known that, that buildings were directly in his line of fire. But I think that if the court were to conclude that the issue was preserved, and Mr. Stallard sort of brought up the felony murder doctrine in common law that we follow, that you know the Supreme Court has specifically declined to extend that to situations where you have a death that results from sort of lawful actions. I think it's strange to have one rule in the context of murder and then a different rule in the context of other crimes. So I essentially would state that if the court does conclude that the issue was preserved, that again, there's not really a lot of case law, if any, on this.
There's not. We couldn't find any. You're right.
But
the issue of proximate cause, if I might ask you a question, you argue that there was no evidence on your motion to strike, that there's no evidence that your client was shot into the building, the Pizza Hut, I believe it was. And then the Commonwealth argues this new and unusual proximate cause issue. And at that point in time, counsel does not object. And then what happens as we proceed on down, and the judge actually embraces that theory, apparently does, because he articulates that. And then so we proceed on down, and evidence is presented by the appellant, and we get to the conclusion of the trial, and yet there's another motion to strike, and the parties do that based upon the same argument as previously stated. And at that point in time, when we're talking about waiver, clearly you knew that the counsel had to know the judge embraced it the first time, so you're there toward the end of the trial, and then we go to argument, because this is a bench trial, you go to argument, and yet there's still no objection as to this theory, this very new theory of proximate cause, and we hear nothing there. And then when we get to your brief and to your argument to us, you seem to somewhat embrace it, and you certainly acquiesce to it in that you say that there's an intervening cause. You take it sort of off in a different direction. But proximate cause has never been embraced by the Commonwealth in reference to this type of charge. Would you agree with that?
I agree that it has not been, yes. I do.
Okay.
I do.
Okay, so either we would be making new law if we go in that direction and conclude that, in fact, you preserve your objection, and you believe you preserve your objection. Is that what you're arguing here today?
I think that's a $64,000 question as to whether that issue was preserved. And again, the issue, trial counsel, as you pointed out very correctly, he made a very short motion to strike at the conclusion of the Commonwealth's evidence. It was one sentence. And then at the conclusion of all of the evidence, I believe he simply says, I renew the motion to strike that I made previously without going into any detail as it relates to what the trial court was saying. So,
And the judge had to embrace the proximate cause issue because there truly was no evidence presented that, in
Correct.
Fact, the appellant's bullet was the one that ended up in the toy box that said Pizza Hut.
Correct. Despite the fact that they recovered those items, and they recovered, presumably, I don't believe it's as clear in the record, but the victim, Mr. Artis, was I'm not going to say taken into custody, but was encountered at that party and presumably had his firearm. So they had bullets and a firearm that they could have at least eliminated or matched or done something, but it wasn't done. I think that you can make the argument it was preserved in light of how much... the Commonwealth clearly took trial counsel's argument in response to it, said it doesn't matter because of the following reasons. And the trial court definitely embraced that, and I agree with the court's interpretation of that. In fact, the court says, I think I know what you mean, he absolutely embraces it. So in terms of the trial court is clearly thinking of the issue in those terms. So I think from that perspective, the court could conclude that the issue was preserved. Trial counsel certainly could have done a better job of flushing that out, but we're all in this, and he had a lot of charges before the court. He was successful in having some strike, There was a lot going on. Finally, the last issue, candidly, I think that's the weakest of the three concerning the identity. I will point out, just to note, I understand what the standard of review is at this point, and we're looking at everything in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, but I would point out, from an evidentiary standpoint, you have the victim, Mr. Artis, the person with the best opportunity to view the perpetrator, specifically testify that though he did not get a very long glance at the suspect, that he looked at him long enough to know that it wasn't the appellant. No one was able to identify the appellant. None of the eyewitnesses on scene were able to identify the appellant as the shooter, and you certainly couldn't discern it, or the trial court couldn't discern the identity of the perpetrator from the surveillance video that was admitted to evidence. Aside from that, I would just reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Sometimes when preparing for an argument, you go back and reread the record, reread the briefs, and there's something that catches your eye that you did not the first time, and you see it slightly differently than you did the first time. And that's kind of where I am right now. Sometimes those last-minute epiphanies are not as good as you think they are, but I'll just throw this out there to the court to consider as you will. I think there was some evidence presented to the court to establish that the defendant was the one who actually did fire the bullets. Basically, we had a video played of the shooting. Now, granted, it was not of great quality. They could not identify who the shooter was. There was some argument whether or not he was actually wearing a green hoodie or a green hoodie with a dark spot in front of it. But the video was played. It showed the two parties engaging in the parking lot. It showed the actual shooting. Now, the trial judge stated on page 210 of the appendix that he was intimately familiar with the layout of this place. He'd actually been to that Pizza Hut before. So I suggest to the court that given the fact that a video was played ostensibly showing the orientation of these two individuals in the parking lot, and the judge knowing the layout of this shopping mall, it put him in a position to actually know, was the defendant in a position to be the one who actually fired the bullets to struck the Pizza Hut or not? Now, I understand during the motion to strike, he did seem to agree with the Commonwealth's position that proximate cause, foreseeability, and so forth. That was the motion to strike prior to the defendant putting on any evidence. I think at the close of evidence, he doesn't say one way or another regarding whether or not, yes, the foreseeability issue is what I'm ruling on. He just denies the motion to strike. And then during his finding of guilt, he says, this is a place I'm familiar with. I've been there. I've been to that Pizza Hut. I know the layout of this mall. I know where it is. I've been there. And he's also seen the video of these people in the parking lot. And I just throw it out there. It's like he was in a position to know, was the defendant able in a position to be the one who would fire the bullets.
So what's the import of the trial judge as trier of fact saying, I know that location? That cuts both ways for you, doesn't it?
Well, I thought about that. I don't know. Is there a judicial taking notice issue that wasn't properly done or whatever? But I think like most fact finders coming to a case, they're going to have certain facts that they know, certain things that they know. And that's what we want in a jury, and I think that's what we want in a trial judge. If the trial judge knew nothing about this, and say, I've never been there, I don't know anything about it.
But it's the Commonwealth's burden of proof at that point.
It is the Commonwealth's burden. Again, like a lot of cases that come before this court, it would be a lot cleaner if everybody had done their job exactly perfectly. We wouldn't have to be here, but that's
the truth. We would be without a job, wouldn't we? Mr. Stallard, in looking at, I understand what you're implying and talking about, because I, too, along with my law clerk, looked at the video and the trajectory as to where the bullet possibly traveled. We don't know because there wasn't any evidence. But there wasn't any evidence put on about it. Looked like it was pointed toward, you know, when you saw the video. I agree, it looked like it was pointed toward Pizza Hut. That's the way the bullet that was the distance the bullet would have traveled into that building. But we didn't have any evidence of that, did we?
Well, there's a question between evidence, circumstantial evidence, and direct evidence, and reasonable inference we could draw from the evidence that was presented. And I think it would be a reasonable inference to draw that, given the video, and given the fact that the finder of fact knew the layout of the shopping center, and the steps that would have known, given the orientation of the shooters, who was in the best position to actually be able to fire the bullets. Now, would it have been better if they'd done some forensic analysis? Would it have been better if they had actually said that? Because I don't think any police officer ever testified that we recovered bullets. It was basically the employees of Pizza Hut saying they told us they recovered stuff. And we don't know if the bullets that were recovered, if they were bullets, were the bullets from this particular shooting or a different shooting. So we don't know if the forensic analysis would have actually been helpful or not helpful. Maybe it would have excluded all the guns. That's just something we don't know at this point.
Mr. Stellar, can you talk perhaps about the waiver as part of the Commonwealth position?
Well, I think to the extent he's arguing that the proximate cause theory doesn't work, there's no objection to that at trial. To the extent he's arguing just a straight up sufficiency, you can't prove my client did the shooting, that's probably preserved. That's obviously the objection made during the motion to strike. So it comes down to both what was said at trial and what the argument is now on appeal. It seems to me he might be trying to make both arguments on appeal, to be fair. But he's clearly arguing that proximate cause doesn't work because it's an intervening cause. So to the extent he's making that argument, I think that is waived because there was no objection to that at the trial court.
Now, what about the fact that, as he points out, the prosecutor responded with certain points and led the trial judge to an inevitable conclusion? Is that enough to say that the trial judge was aware of the issue and essentially implicitly rule on it?
Well, I mean, to me, the closest analogy, and again, I'm not good at analogies, so forgive me in front, but the closest analogy I would come to is there's three or four people involved in an attack of an individual with attempted robbery. One of the four individuals shoots the victim with a malicious wound. All four are charged with it. Counsel for one of the defendants says, well, there's no proof my guy was the one who did the shooting. Come up and says, well, counselor of action, they're all guilty. And then there's no further objections. He then can't challenge the conservation theory on appeal because he didn't object to that and say, judge, that's not a thing. It doesn't work in this case for whatever reason he wants to say. And likewise here, once the Commonwealth said, you know, foreseeability, proximate cause, he could have said, that's not a thing, judge. Commonwealth doesn't recognize that for me. He didn't do that. So he allowed the trial judge potentially to go down an area of law that really there is no law there yet. And because there was no objection, he didn't alert the trial judge, you know, it's not a thing, judge. And I think all parties kind of have the duty to kind of hopefully keep the judge on track. And here, I mean, the defense counsel didn't do that. So to the extent that's an issue, I think there is a waiver to that. And I think he had an obligation to object to the trial court's finding that proximate cause was an issue, and he did not do that. So to the extent that's waived. To the extent he's arguing, you need to prove my guy did the shooting. That objection was made at trial, and that is preserved for appeal. So to the extent the court finds that that's the argument he is making on appeal, that's preserved. And I would suggest the argument I made earlier would be the counter to that, which is there is evidence before the court, and the court had an opportunity to see that evidence and make a determination, that we can't just out of hand say, well, there's no evidence. Well, I think there is some circumstantial evidence, which, as a matter of fact, could make reasonable inferences that, in fact, the defendant was the one who did the shooting.
What do you say about the sentencing circumstances?
Now, I realize we're not supposed to be outside the record, but I will say part of what I did was I did contact the Department of Corrections to find out what orders they did, in fact, have regarding what his sentence was. They have them for a 10-year sentence. Based on that representation made to me, I suggest to the court that the order that was sentencing him to 10 years is the order that the order DOC apparently has. The order reflecting what happened at the hearing later is clearly an error. I think it would be appropriate to remand that to correct that error. I don't think it's a sentencing problem. As far as I can tell, DOC does not think a sentence is 20 years.
The concern is, and I appreciate where your former colleague would be coming from, is that there is some order out there that basically puts his client potentially in a bad situation. And we have seen those cases where the Department of Corrections gets a hold of something and they just won't let it go, where everybody agrees that it's wrong.
Right, and I don't disagree with the court. I don't think there's a problem with the sentencing order. I think the sentencing order is fine. I think this order that came afterwards, which is not a sentencing order, is an error, and it probably should be corrected.
So maybe sending something back to the trial court, instructing the trial court to vacate that order or do something.
To vacate, correct the clerical error, yes. I think that would be more than appropriate. Out of abundance of caution, I don't think it's going to impact the sentence. It hasn't, as of now, anyway, impacted the sentence. But
and with the permission of the presiding judge, I'm going to ask counsel, is that satisfactory to you?
That does. Absolutely. I just want some mechanism to undo that order for the reasons that Your Honor stated. You know, that sometimes DOC gets a hold of these things. And
okay. I think we're all on the same page as far as that's concerned.
And regarding the sufficiency of the identity of the perpetrator for the remaining charges, I think the evidence is ample. The statements to police when we went to the hospital, the statement of the victim at the time of the shooting, the circumstantial evidence regarding the green hoodie found at his mom's house, and it having the hole practically in the same location where the defendant himself had a bullet wound. Jim's deposit check for GSR residue, the video itself, I believe there's ample evidence to establish he was the person who did the attempted murder, used the firearm in that attempted murder. Unless, of course, if there are any additional questions, I'd ask that you affirm the convictions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Shepherd.
Just
a little over 3 minutes.
Thank you, Judge. Just briefly concerning what Mr. Staller brought up about there being direct evidence in the record in support of the idea that the appellant was the shooter. I'd say a couple of things on that. One, the trial court, if it's taking into account its personal knowledge of the area and no one has asked it to sort of take judicial notice of the layout or anything like that, I think the trial court would be assuming facts that aren't really before it, aren't really in evidence.
But what about a requirement of an objection?
I mean, I think that is the stronger argument of the two, honestly. And I can't go. I mean, I can't go back and make a more specific argument on that. I will say though that I mean, he specifically says that I'm quoting from the sentence in which he argues that this charge should be struck. There was never any testimony as to who was actually shooting at the building, even if you accept the Commonwealth's case. So I understand that that's vague. But I will simply submit that I think from that argument, the Commonwealth's response to it, which, by the way, I will point out that they never argued at all that there was any direct evidence in support of Pellant's bullets being the ones in the building. And certainly if they felt that way, I would submit that they would have argued that pretty strenuously. And I would also point out, just very briefly, the trial court didn't go that direction either. They both clearly thrust it in there. So, you know, I understand where Mr. Staller is coming from with the, you know, is the proximate cause issue preserved? Because, again, he didn't bring it up initially, and he certainly didn't object to it once the court had sort of walked down the path. But if there's no direct evidence that appellant actually fired into the building, the only way they get there, the only way they get there is through sort of the proximate cause theory. So there's really only, you can either get there by direct evidence, he was the one who did it, or he is responsible by initiating the course of conduct. So you really only have two options to get to where the trial court ultimately did chose the second of the two. You know, beyond that, if the court has any additional questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but.
No questions, and thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll come down and brief counsel and then hear the Gibbs case.